I'm in an extremely silent environment right now. I'm in the kayak up the Kaitoki River here on Aotea, Great Barrier Island. All I can hear is a few birds, a couple of drops of rain falling here and there, no wind, there's no planes, no cars. Probably the quietest environment I've ever recorded a radio show in. I'm a couple of kilometers from the ocean. This is Jeff Wafferson Phillips, by the way. Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 221. It was important to me to record this show while being on the water, because this show is called Honoring Water-Based Life. Why nature is my greatest inspiration. Last week's show was about what we call computers and electronic technology as not necessarily being a form of extraterrestrial intelligence, although that's not actually impossible. It's pretty science fiction. And that whole scenario, as Dr. Lilly saw in his vision, was very dark and very paranoid, but I don't think it's unrealistic. But the flip side of that whole scenario is that I only pay attention to that kind of thing because of my very, very, very deep, profound, intrinsic love of everything and everyone that's alive, and Mother Earth, Mother Nature herself. If I didn't love Mother Earth and my fellow life forms so deeply, I wouldn't be bothered to report and investigate all the horrific destruction and damage that my species is wreaking on Mother Earth, but that is the sole reason I do it. I hope people don't think that I somehow enjoy dealing with all that stuff. It's actually very painful at times, and I try to do my best with it, but I don't love all that stuff. I do have the ability to kind of understand what it is, but in no way can I begin to understand the mentality behind the creation and deployment of all those systems of destructions and weapon systems and things like that. I'm so much the opposite. My true self is a lover of nature and of Mother Earth and all my fellow beings. That's what this show is about. That's really what I'm all about in a nutshell. That's what my whole life revolves around, my connection with nature and my love of her and all the kingdoms of life and all the forms of what you might call, I'll use the word God, not in the sense of the God of any specific religion, but in the sense of a vast creative intelligence that's very much bigger than me. God, in that sense, God's art is the universe and nature and living things, fellow beings, our family of life, our ancestors. It's very interesting. I wanted to point out that this last week in October, 2 years ago, is when I'd been spending my most continuous and intensive encounter with dolphins here on Aotea or Great Barrier Island, which I refer to this island because of my experiences here, a sacred place of guidance for the whales and dolphins. And in Māori, that's He Wahi Tapu Wahi Arahi Mai Inya Tahora Mengnya Aihi. Sacred place of guidance from whales and dolphins. And in late October of 2015, I'd been over camping out at Haratanga with Grandmother Pahutukawa, and I looked out and saw a couple of dolphins, and I had a didge that I was trying to play, so I played some didge sounds in that way, out towards them, and flute and drums, and really called out to them, both spiritually and acoustically, asking them to please come over to Arafaro, or Medlands Beach, where I stay. And lo and behold, the next day, they were there. I mean, some dolphins were there. I'm guessing it might have been the same months, but they were there. But not only were they there, they stayed. They were there for a long time, every day for like a week. And I went out there every day to be with them and had some amazing encounters. Like, for example, one day they were swimming, you know, maybe 50, 80 meters off the beach, and I started playing my flute and drum and clapping on the water. And all of a sudden, two of them came over right towards me, and I was standing in water about, not even up to my knees, very close to the shoreline, and two dolphins kind of surfed in on a wave, and they came on either side of me, each less than a meter from me, one on my right and one on my left, and the one on the right swam back out, and the one on the left turned over and laid there in water that wasn't even a third of a meter deep, looking up at me just for a few seconds. And I didn't try, for some reason I thought it was a female, but the energy of this being was just, in no way can I put it into words, but I was just totally blown away at the beauty and the spiritual power and the gentleness and the love and the sleek streamlinedness of her body and the sunlight glimmering through the water there. Just these few seconds, or it might have been 10 or 20 seconds, maybe not that long, but I was just dumbfounded. And then a few days later, I was filming a bunch of dolphins right on the other side of Memory Island. They were, I won't call it surfing on a wave, but when a wave would come, they wouldn't ride it in like a surfer. They would shoot long ways down through the wave itself, but long ways for 2 or 3 seconds, but it's so fast. I mean, I know dolphins can accelerate that fast, but I've never actually seen them do it. They would accelerate to just unbelievable speed just for a split second. Really, really, and I got all this on video. And that was the day that I had to pull myself out of the water. I was standing in water over my waist with my video cameras in order to film them, because I don't have underwater photography gear. I had to make myself get out of the water and get on my bicycle and ride, because I had an appointment with the council about some environmental issues here on Great Barrier Island, some of which had to do with the dolphins, the plane noise, dogs on the beach, different kind of things like that. And that on my way over there is when I had my bicycle accident, where I came off and had some fractured vertebrae in my neck and had to be hospitalized. That was on the 11th of November, 2015. Well, anyway, during the last week of October in 2015, I'd been swimming with these dolphins, and just after they had been there for a small number of days, I came back and was sitting there painting at my little table after just being with the dolphins, and all of a sudden, an image appeared in my mind, very powerful and very clear, and I just went like, wow. And I was sure that it was transmitted to me by the dolphins. It was just a very unusual experience, because I flash on images and stuff now and then, but it's very subtle, and I know that those come from within me, but this definitely seemed to originate outside of me, and it was clear that it came from the dolphins, and it was an image but also a meaning. And I instantly drew my impression, kind of a picture of what it was, and when I started thinking about it, it blew me away, and it still blows me away, because what it was an impression of what a comet or asteroid or some kind of extraplanetary body might look like as it was passing through the atmosphere, coming straight toward whoever was looking. So this is something that you wouldn't think that you'd live to tell if you ever saw something like this, because, and so the implications were that the ancestors of the dolphins that are alive now had witnessed something like that, and that this is sort of in their collective unconscious, their collective memory, which I think that they have a vast collective memory, astronomically greater than ours. Their whole minds and brains and cognitional processes are light years beyond us. We try to compare or measure them in terms of our own puny hard and software, our own models and simulations, and it just doesn't fit when we try to project the concept of intelligence onto dolphins or whales or any other thing in nature. It doesn't work. It's too sterile, too low resolution, too anthropomorphic. But so this image of the comet or asteroid kind of exploding as it's passing through the atmosphere, my intuition was that the dolphins were telling me two things. They were telling me that their ancestors had witnessed this, but yet lived to tell. And that something like this may well be on the verge of happening again. And this really, really, really blew me away, because comets had already been looming on my personal radar quite large, but this really took it all to the next level. There is massive evidence that Mother Earth has been impacted by celestial bodies, comets, comet fragments, asteroids, giant meteors. I mean, it happens probably many, many thousands of times a day, but most of them burn up. But when the pieces are large enough that they don't burn up, even a tiny one can create quite an impact. But larger ones can destroy whole regions, even cause giant tidal waves and tsunamis and atmosphere darkening aftermaths that might extinguish a lot of life. Some of the mass extinction events are believed to have been initiated or triggered by cataclysmic collisions like this. Who knows? None of us were there. But what's very interesting is that it was this exact week when the dolphins transmitted that image to me. I don't have the exact day, but I know it was during the last week in October. Well, what really blew me away was when I was doing some research a few months ago, after I had visited some comet researchers like Malcolm Hartley up at the Siding Spring Observatory in the Warrumbungles in New South Wales. I was doing a lot of research on comets, and I started reading about Comet Encke, E-N-K-E. And researchers believe, especially this guy named Victor Klube, that the fragments of Comet Encke are what create the Taurid meteors, which appear to emanate from the constellation Taurus, and that there's two windows of time each year when the Earth's orbit passes through the orbit or trajectory of these Encke fragments, that there's these two windows of time during which we see these meteors, and that a collision with a fragment, some of which are believed to be quite large, is much more likely to happen. And these two windows of time are late June and early July, and late October and early November. So the dolphins transmitted this image to me about a cometary impact during the most likely time of the year when it would happen. And these same researchers, some guys from the Czech Republic, just published a paper recently about that they think that they've discovered some larger fragments sort of hiding behind some debris that could be the larger ones that Klube predicted might exist. This whole scenario ties in with the whole school of thought known as catastrophism. I've talked about Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky a lot on my show, and his ideas based on many different fields of scientific inquiry, psychoanalysis, cultural history, astronomy, geology. But we know for sure that the Earth has been impacted by extraterrestrially originating catastrophic events a lot throughout her history, from geological evidence and from cultural evidence that these kind of events have happened while people have been here, even in almost what you might call historical times in the past few thousand years. So life on Earth is very resilient. She's made it through a lot of planetary level catastrophes that might have almost wiped out life, all larger life forms, but there was still a lot left to carry the ability to reproduce and start over with something totally new. So this could actually be part of the true nature of life herself, is being pruned down regularly, which creates an opportunity for whole new forms of creative experimentation. But who knows? We're just speculating about the consciousness of a planet and the true nature of the living process, the creative process of life herself. But my heart does feel really heavy and sad sometimes the more I research the damage that we're doing to Mother Earth and our fellow beings. And I know a lot of people get tired of hearing me talk about it, and they'll even unsubscribe from my email list. Or this one guy last week told me that I was deluded because of my post on the computer technology. You be the judge. You look around and see what's happening in the world. I don't tell anybody what's really how anything is, or I report things as I see it and try to give people food for thought so that they can do their own legwork and come up with their own ideas. But this show is about my true love of Mother Nature and Mother Earth, and you've got to just go out and be with her. You've got to be out in nature long enough for your whole vibration to change, for all your civilized vibes and the noise ringing in your ears and the electrical vibrations from your office or the environment where you live, and let all that sort of die down. It's so weird to be here. It's so freaky because normally here on this island, I'm normally near the ocean, and you hear the sound of the ocean in the background, and here I'm far enough away that I don't hear the ocean. When there's almost no wind, just a few little birdies here and there. Some insects flying around. One of the shows I'm going to do soon is about bioacoustics and the sacredness of sound, the importance of silence, and the very destructive nature of noise. But I've talked before about how, especially on a place called Flinders Island, where my former partner, Lisbeth, and I were able to live there at a remote place near the ocean with absolutely no electricity at all, except for a tiny, tiny little solar panel that ran a radio. We had no electricity, and we were able to live without it. We'd go to town about once every 2 weeks and charge up our batteries and get some groceries and stuff, and we loved it. We'd burn candles for light in the early evening and get up really early before it got light. And our whole system just sort of recalibrated to become very, very, very sensitive to feelings and vibrations. Really, for the first time in our lives. And that has stayed with me ever since. That sort of sets the new standard for your own personal sensitivity and feelings. And so then you can sort of maintain that. You don't have to lose it. When you have to go back into an urban environment or the places where you have to spend most of your time, you notice some of the sensitivities being blotted out. Well, I mean, literally, like block. So, for example, if you're here listening to a very delicate, quiet little bird song, and then a plane flies over, it not only casts its own sort of sinister vibration from the sound of the chugging of the machine and the churning of the air from the propeller, but it's not only its sound. There's some caucus. It's not only the sound of the plane itself, but the fact that it's blocking or masking what you were trying to hear. So it's a twofold process. So the noise thing is an issue related to my love of nature, as is the whole sort of demented, distributed mental operating environment that I talk about, that modern humanity seems to be burdened with at this time. And that's behind our destructiveness, our views toward nature and our fellow beings, and what we're okay with, what we're comfortable with allowing to happen and be in denial of and non-acknowledgement of our complicity. But these are not topics for this show either. They're very important. But Mother Nature, I know that's a generalization, but the world of everything that's alive is just so enchanted and magical. And especially my experience here on Aotea, Great Barrier Island, she's just such a special place. And development is happening in the area where I'm very blessed to be able to live for a few months of every year, thanks to my beautiful, beautiful, generous, magnanimous, loving friends, John, Peggy, and Garlic, at Medlands Beach or Arafara there. That's probably the most highly developed Sunset Strip part of Great Barrier Island. And to make matters worse, there's been a massive atrocity $2 million holiday home that's been going up right in the backyard, and that's just about finished. But that added another level of unbelievable construction noise that went on for at least 8 hours a day for a year, that the Garlics had to live with for this whole time, and me only while I'm here. But when you get away from there and out to some of my very favorite nature places here, like Haratanga, where Grandmother Pahutukawa tree lives, and the Haratanga Coast Walk on some really beautiful, spectacular cliffs. I did part of that this past week, starting at Whangapoa Bay. Whangapoa is one of the largest undisrupted estuaries left in New Zealand. Climbing Mount Hirakamata, in whose wetland I am right now, the Kaitoki River. Her headwaters come from the massive wetland below the southern slopes of the Hirakamata volcanic complex. Hirakamata is the tallest mountain on Aotea at 687 meters. Very, very, very powerful, very beautiful. When you go up and be with a place like Hirakamata, like I did last week, I just really feel the spirit of the place as a being who knows me while I'm there. And I was up there on the top among the cloud beings, playing my flute and my drum and burning my sage. And then when I was on the Haratanga Coast Walk this past week, as I was almost back to the car, a little cloud of rain came. It was basically clear, but a little cloud of rain came. I could see it in the distance. It looked like a mist, and it came over me, little drops of rain. And then when I got to the car, I looked up, and there was the most beautiful, very, very brilliant Aniwaniwa, or rainbow. And I really felt like that was a communication from the nature divas. Because I was probably the only person that saw it, but it came. I really felt like it was a form of communication. But to be out and experience all of our fellow life forms, like the birds, and the bees, and the trees, and the rocks and minerals and crystals, and the stars and the clouds, and everybody, as not just magnificent creatures or spectacular landscapes, but as fellow beings who have lived on Mother Earth far longer than us, and they are truly our ancestors. That's a central concept of the Dreamtime cosmology of Australia. And it's quite similar to the psychological concept of archetypes. Probably archetypes of nature are the same as ancestors. It's very interesting. One of the coolest things anyone ever said about me was this guy in Tasmania about 3 years ago. He goes, like, Jeff, I think you're a pantheist. And I knew what that meant. A pantheism is like, it means that you consider everything that's alive as sacred. And that really is exactly how I feel. And even though, to be technical, you know, it's like I'm sitting on a bunch of amoebas right now and probably squashing them. And, you know, I'm not trying to hurt them on purpose. And I'm not a freak about all this stuff. I try to rescue little bugs to get in my paint. And if I had some ants in my computer the other day, and I accidentally killed some of them, but most of them I tried to just blow or flick away. I don't want to hurt anything if I can help it. And that's so presumptuous, because who could be thinking of us in that exact same way? But I'd like to share some of my beautiful experiences with the kingdoms of life here in the past few weeks on Great Barrier. My heroes, the dolphins, they haven't been around all that much, definitely not like 2 years ago. But there was one day when there was three or four that were here, and just the fact that they were there going up and down the beach all day, it really brought such a beautiful, joyful energy to me. And I think it was a combination of my happiness at seeing them and just the psychological joy from knowing that they were there and that I could see them and was close, but also the actual energies that they emit, like their force field or their giant auras. I think that they really do have that, and especially for people who really are tuned in with them. And also it could even be that they were ones that I had met before, you know, so it's like they might have, who knows what kind of connections could exist. But that it made that whole day really magical, and then for the next two or three days the energy was still there too. Once a couple of years ago I had a really cool encounter with a little octopus in the rock pool here, but also at Wamboral Lagoon in New South Wales, a little octopus. I encountered the same octopus twice, and I was sure that the second time it recognized me because it stuck out its little tentacle and actually touched me. And I've had a couple of really beautiful experiences with honeybees. Here, one came and was on my desk walking around. I thought something was wrong with him, and he would kind of shake and move, but he seemed to be fine, and he would buzz his wings a little bit, and I filmed him and photographed him, and then after about 30 minutes he just flew away. So that was a very interesting little encounter. And then I was on the beach one day and was standing there, and I felt a sting on my foot, and I looked down, and there was a honeybee that stung me on the in the ocean. I mean, just right by where the ocean was going to come. And so I picked him up on the end of my finger and brought him back to my desk. And he walked around for about 10 or 15 minutes, but then he was fine, and he flew away too. And so I don't know why honeybees would be down on the beach. Because if I hadn't rescued him, he surely would have got washed away by the ocean. Maybe he thought he was a dolphin and he was stranding. The kingdom of the birds. There's so many birds on Aotea. And New Zealand as a whole used to be islands of nothing but birds. There was no mammals here except for a bat. Islands of birds, many of them really huge and flightless, and most of them have been extincted or their numbers have dwindled down. But there's about 10 varieties of birds here that I hear, see, or encounter daily. The tuis, which is a beautiful songbird with two voice boxes. The roo-roos, or the little morporks, or the boo-books, they go, whoo-hoo, whoo-hoo. They're so sweet sounding. You usually hear them when it starts to get dark. The kakas, which is like a parrot. You just heard some a few minutes ago. The kotaris, they're the little sacred kingfisher, the same one I heard in Darwin. They go, got the albatross diving down in the ocean, and the seagulls, and the oyster catchers, and the dotterels live on the beach and nest. And we've got the kahu, which is the hawk, and the kareru, which is the wood pigeon, and you've got the kakarikis, which is the little chattering parrot, kind of like a small Rosella, that lives, a lot of them live at the Okiwi Reserve, and I actually heard one over at Arafura this morning. And then I've got five kind of birds that come into my cottage to eat some of the breadcrumbs that I conveniently leave for them. And the thrush and the chaffinch actually come and ask for some bread. Not in English, of course, but the chaffinch comes, he goes, beep, beep. He makes little sounds. It's like he's asking. He's going like, I'm here. Can I have some bread, please? And then the thrush will stand there and he'll just start singing. And so it's like they're busking for bread. It's so lovely. And the sparrows will come in. And the banded rail comes from across the street. And he or she will come in and just hang out and stand there on my medicine wheel. And they'll all come inside. They'll come inside and walk around. They don't walk on my feet, but they'll be like, you know, less than a meter from me and go, and they'll actually come pretty far inside and go walking around in between my things on the floor. And then there's the ducks. I love the ducks, but they're just a bit much sometimes. They come in and they'll sort of like waddle all around and they trample on stuff. And if there's any bread on the ground, they'll try to eat it all up. They'll gobble it all up before anybody else can get it. So I kind of shoo them away sometimes. And the plant kingdom, there's beautiful Pohutukawa trees here. Grandmother Pohutukawa, she might be even able to hear us from here, but Grandmother Pohutukawa, can you hear us?
Yes, Jeffrey, I'm with you now. I'm able to tune into where you are, all of our Pohutukawas, and I wanted to thank you. It was lovely of you to burn the sage and play your flute for my sister at the beach at Haratonga Walk the other day before you saw the beautiful Aniwaniwa.
Well, thanks, Grandmother Pohutukawa. That was a beautiful, beautiful experience. But yeah, the Pohutukawa, it's like I feel that each species of tree, like every individual is connected with every other individual, and it's on sort of like the Pohutukawa consciousness network. And there's several that I know. There's ones that I call Rachel Carson and Black Elk up on the above the dunes at Arafura. There's ones down at the end of either beach. They're very, very, very lovely. And then there's the cowry trees, and there's the cabbage trees, and there's the nikau, the beautiful palms. And then around the house there, I've got my go-to cola. That's such a special little plant. And it's grown very, very well. It's starting to branch out into the yard, and John and Peggy Ann have mixed feelings about it, but I keep telling them what a blessing it is. People use it as a ground cover. It's just as nice as, it's nicer than grass because you don't have to mow it. And it's, but the main thing is it's the most important plant in the whole Ayurvedic medicine tradition from India. You're supposed to eat a few leaves every day, which I've been doing the whole time I'm here, to eat it fresh. This is my ultimate go-to cola garden. And I've got one in a pot that I'm going to bring with me. But it's just such a blessing. I mean, this, it's got about 60 different medicinal uses in the Ayurvedic tradition. I've got my, the go-to cola is called Centella Asiatica. And then I've got my beautiful Salvia Apiana, the grandfather white sage that my friend Michael grows in Victoria. That's my most beautiful plant that I burn the smoke every morning and every evening when I offer my greetings and thanks and prayers to the Great Spirit and the grandmothers and grandfathers of all the directions. And there's so many flowers around now too. There's this beautiful pink flower on the dunes that blooms just in October, and all these different flowers in the gardens, and I've got these bouquets, and there's all kind of veggies growing. I've been eating lots of fresh silver beet and kale, and now Peggy Ann's got some awesome tomatoes, and I've got all these little capsicums that are coming up. There's some beautiful roses. It's and just all the wildflowers on the dunes, and like the grass coming up from the, I'm sort of in this little area off to the side of the river where I can sit still. There's all kind of really tall grass coming up out of the wetland here. And the clouds and the wind. Now, I've learned that the ancient Greek word for cloud is nephos, N-E-P-H-O-S. So the study of clouds would be nephology. And I've really been noticing in recent years, as have a lot of people, that the weather has been very, very disrupted. You can just feel it. You can tell. Sometimes you can see really weird artificial looking clouds and weather patterns. And here it's especially been the wind the past few weeks. It's just been unnaturally windy. But that's a whole topic of geophysical warfare that I've talked about before. But I've really come to feel that the wind is a being, and I've, even though I've got angry with him a few times, which is really stupid, but sometimes you just can't take it anymore. But I've apologized to Brother Wind and realized that he might be being forced to do things that he doesn't really want to do. But today, when I came out with the kayak here, it was blowing up, very windy, and it was going to start to rain. And I waited for about 30 minutes, and now some blue skies appeared, and the wind died down to nothing, and it just rained a few drops. And it's been very, very, very beautiful. The star nations, all the stars, including the sun, and Merima, the moon, and all the comets and asteroids, and that's a whole universe unto itself when you think about all the different stars and the planets that might be there and who the stars are. This is all part of the world of nature, the natural world. It's such a miracle that we're here. And I really feel like that a big part of our true nature, our purpose as human beings, is there's nothing wrong with our true nature and nothing wrong with our biology. It's like we're really the ultimate technology. It's just that our mental operating environment is the part that's really distorted right now. But we're supposed to live in such a way that honors the sacredness of life and honors the beauty and power of all of our family of life. And to walk in beauty on a path with heart, and using our creativity in ways that reflect or mimic or mirror the creativity of Mother Earth and nature and the cosmos. And that's what I really try to do with my life, but I feel like that we have eyes and ears that are incredibly sensitive, and we have hearts, and we have hands, and we have feet, and we can walk on the earth and touch her and all our family of life, and we can see the stars and hear the birds and swim in the water. This is what we're really meant to do. But we can never really understand what life is. We're a part of it. And it comes into sharper focus, contrasting the beauty and power of life when you're up against the unbelievable destructiveness that's happening all over Mother Earth right now, which is probably the dominant topic that I talk about on this radio show, because I think we are on the brink. We're on the brink of what the Hopis call the Day of Purification, because Mother Earth does love us, but she can't take too much more punishment, because she's not going to allow one of her children to endanger the well-being of everyone, and including her. So that's why it's very interesting that the dolphins sent me that image of the comet impact just about this exact time of year 2 years ago, and that I'm actually talking with you about it right now during that same window of time. But if we learn how to think like a planet, and I think that it's not something that you necessarily would sit in your chair at your computer and try to think like a planet. I think that when you get out and be with Mother Earth, and get away from civilized vibrations and electricity and noise for a long enough time, you become resonant with the consciousness of Mother Earth, and you start to feel her feelings and know her thoughts. And this is kind of neo-shamanic in a way, but I think it's really our true nature. So you don't really have to. It's more like what you should stop doing that allows the natural vibrations to become your reality. It's more about stopping what you're doing to block it out, rather than that you don't have to go out and take a bunch of ayahuasca or anything like that in order to be connected with the spirit and consciousness of Mother Earth. Au contraire. You just need to stop blocking out everything that's getting in the way. But when you do, every little being is playful and alive and has a little something to share with you, because every little being is aware of us too. Every ant, every little fly, every little honeybee, every bird, the clouds, the trees, there's beings that you might call devas, little spirits that I think there's a deva that's kind of like the consciousness of every form of life, a deva for each, not necessarily for each individual, but the deva of all the Pahutukawa trees, and the deva of the dolphins, and the deva of the turtles, and the deva of the dragonflies. And I don't know, it's just, you can't really comprehend, but you can feel it. And I just really, my love for Mother Earth and the beauty of nature and just the infinite beauty of the patterns of nature, I could just spend the rest of my life doing nothing but going around looking at and listening to the patterns of nature and photographing and filming. In fact, one of my ideas for a film, it's called Biodelic. It's just an idea for a film or a series of films to just be nothing but patterns of nature at all different levels, and many of them would be overlaid, bringing out different sort of new patterns that would emerge from the intersection of two or three layers of different things, and then create beautiful music to go along with that. And what the sounds of nature, there's a guy named Bernie Krauss that has founded a discipline called acoustic ecology, and he's not really looking at noise so much as he is recording and analyzing the soundscape of an ecological niche, and then you can determine a lot about who lives there and what their health levels are from the acoustics, and that's very interesting. But if you just listen to an acoustic landscape that has no human sound, it's very much like a very subtle form of music. It doesn't have the long, continuous notes of a specific frequency like Western music has, but it's like a tapestry of harmonious sounds that all have waveform and harmonic characteristics that blend together nicely. There's nothing intrusive about natural sounds. I mean, you might have the sound of a thunderclap or a piece of an iceberg breaking off or a rock falling down or a tree limb breaking or something like that, but those are relatively few and far between. But it's the human noise. It just wrenches my gut sometimes. And to hear the same machines over and over again many times a day, like the planes here on Great Barrier Island, that some of them sound like chainsaws in the sky. I'm really working on a way to attenuate this plane noise, because that's the single most intrusive thing for me on this whole island. It's a nice little fly flying around. But to be able to experience the music and silence of nature, undisrupted by the violations of human intrusion, allows you to directly connect with the true sacredness of what it means to be alive on Mother Earth, to be a living being, to be breathing, and to be feeling and hearing and seeing and touching and embedded in a cosmic context that's existed for billions of years. And we're just one trillions of forms of life that have existed on Mother Earth. And she's going to make it regardless of what we do. But it's just so sad that in our hearts, so much of humanity has totally lost the plot of loving Mother Earth. But for those of us who still do, she will let you know and send you the most beautiful gifts for your heart and soul that you can imagine. And this is what inspires everything I do, my activism, my investigative journalism, my art, my music, my photography, my filmmaking. Everything I do revolves around my love of Mother Earth and Mother Nature and my fellow beings and my desire to protect them and create awareness about them, but to share the beauty and power of knowing my ancestors and my family of life, and to inspire others to do the same, and so that we might indeed live simply so that others may simply live. I can't get over how quiet it is here. The spirit of water-based life. There could be water-based life on other planets. That was Dr. John Lilly's vision, that water-based life is very rare in the universe, that the solid-state life based on silicon is much more common and widespread because it can exist in a lot wider range of conditions. It can exist in extreme heat, extreme cold, in on planets or environments that have no atmosphere. Whereas water-based life is much more delicate. She requires the presence of water and a protective envelope, an atmosphere that can hold water vapor, and with the right chemical constitution, it doesn't necessarily have to have an abundance of oxygen, only to have for aerobic life like we are. But you could have anaerobic life like the cyanobacteria, which is probably what the Earth's atmosphere was like. The majority of its existence did not have very much oxygen. It's only when the plant kingdom came along that the oxygen content rose that's enabled larger animal life to exist. It's an unbelievably intricate and improbably cool synergetic symbiosis of all these different amazing dimensions that make life possible, that we're embedded in, and how we can sit around and watch really stupid stuff on TV and worry about all these idiots that are the political leaders and stuff, when you could go outside and look at the stars and smell some flowers and listen to some birds and swim with dolphins and go for a bicycle ride up a mountain. To me, it's mentally ill for people to make those kind of choices, to choose not to be with nature when they could. But that's a value judgment. Anyway, I'm going to do a little more kayaking here. Thanks for listening. Mother Earth loves us all so much. Please act as if you love her, and not just in words, but in what you do and don't do. This is Jeff Wefferson Phillips signing off for On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 221. He wahi tapu, wahi rahimai, inya tahora, inya ahi, me inya aniwaniwa. Thank you.
We'll be right back.